All right, welcome to the RSP Cast. This is episode 2 of Scout Talk with Russ Landy. And Russ, last week was just a great conversation that we had talking about scouting, as well as some players that we've been watching for the 2020 draft. Welcome back to the show, and it's going to be really a great series having you on.
I'm excited, man. Anytime we get to talk football, I know we've talked for years about different aspects of scouting and the chance to finally put this together. I'm pumped to keep grinding on this.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that one of the things that's been interesting is, in the wake of last night's game with Sam Darnold, who's, in the middle of his second year and missed a good portion of the first part of that second year, and what happened to him against the Patriots, where they just pretty much played cover zero and blitzed him to death, and him even saying on the sideline that he's seen ghosts, I think a good kind of relevant question for the week is, what are some realistic timelines for players to acclimate entering the NFL? And do you look at by specific position, or do you look at it on a more individual basis?
I think it's a great topic, because I think so much is said of, he's not starting by his fifth game of his rookie year, regardless of whether it's a quarterback or a receiver or a defensive end. And people want to start labeling them busts, sort of like Jared Goff after his rookie year, where he started 5 or 6 games and wasn't great. But yes, position plays a part of it, because obviously a running back or maybe an edge rusher might be a little bit easier to incorporate, even if he doesn't have everything down. But it really is an individual situation. And when I look back at just certain players that I scouted when I was, whether I was in the NFL or CFL, and you were like, yep, I'm sure this guy's going to step in. And then as soon as you get him in your building and you get him in your playbook, you get him in the meetings with the coaches, not on the practice field, you all of a sudden realize either, A, yep, we nailed it, this guy's ready, or you know what? We got to temper our expectations. Now that we've got him here, we think physically it's all there, but it's just going to take him longer to make that transition to get on the field. And we may have to say, it's going to be half a season or a year. And one of the great things that I sort of related to, and obviously I've been doing this forever, but the year that Jared Goff and Carson Wentz came out of school, you had a Goff, obviously a 3-year starter, a true junior out of Cal, major program, Big Five conference. And you had Carson Wentz, who started 1 million games, but it was at North Dakota State. So obviously a lower level of competition. And I spoke to a ton of scouts around the league, specifically some of the Rams and some of the Eagles, because they, after their trades, they interviewed both these kids. Every one of them prior to the draft insisted that Jared Goff, based on the interviews, putting him on the board, the film, the fact that he played at Cal, top-level competition, that he was the guy who was ready to come in day one, and that Wentz was going to need time, and he was the guy that was probably a year or two from claiming that starting job. Then the draft happens. Both players get their playbooks. They go through rookie minicamp either the first weekend or second weekend after the draft. I don't remember specifically which team did which. But then I spoke to the scouts on both teams, and they both had drastically different opinions. The Rams guys said, hey, you know what? We love Goff. We still think he's going to be a star, but he's not going to be day one ready. He needs time. It's going to be a process for him to adjust to the NFL, and they were still very confident and felt he was going to be their franchise quarterback, and they were excited that they made the trade to get him because they loved the kid and they thought his future was super bright. But they just said, hey, we got to hold back. We can't throw him to the Wolves, whereas the people at the Eagles said, wow, we're stunned. Wentz could come in there tomorrow, and he'd probably be able to handle it. They said, obviously, he'd make rookie mistakes, but he's far more advanced in terms of picking up what we gave him in the playbook and getting out there on the field in rookie minicamp. So it's just a great example that you don't really know on any kid at any position until they're in your building, even though some positions are definitely easier than others to make that transition.
So I want to follow up with you about that story because, one of the things that was interesting to me without having any knowledge of what you did is, that you would learn from talking with scouts and talking to the coaches and talking with people from both those organizations is that, in hindsight, when Goff didn't work out very well, I wrote this piece about supporting cast, about playbook, about scheme fits, and how, for Goff, going from an air raid offense, which is kind of like, in a really simplified way, is a very distilled version of the West Coast offense at its roots, going to a full-blown West Coast offense, which many people would say is one of the hardest offenses to learn because of the verbiage and the detail of that verbiage for, wide receiver splits, movement, all of that kind of thing, that it was like learning Chinese for him. And if you're going to thrust him into you know, onto the field early on, it's like giving someone like 2 months of like, you know, tape recording Chinese lessons and then going in the middle of a square in Beijing and you've had a little too much to drink and now you have to go to the bathroom and you have to ask for directions. And someone's like, you know, go, you know, 5 blocks down this way. There's a purple door at the end of this alley on the left. And then you knock on that door 3 times and there's going to be an old woman in a pink hat that answers and you go up 3 flights of stairs. And then at the end of the hallway, there's going to be a star with a on the chest of a dragon. That's a blue dragon. Make sure it's not the one with the red dragon. And that's where the bathroom is. And if you, I mean, and they're talking as fast as I was in Chinese, you know, exactly. And it's yep. like, how are you going to, if you even held your water at that point, how are you even like, you know, how you're not even going to make heads or tails of that. And I think that's where Goff was. But the, you know, for me, the question is then, you know, Wentz, we knew played in a West Coast offense of some format in North Dakota State, whereas Goff, we look at in hindsight. And so it's easy for the hindsight people like myself to go, well, it makes sense that Goff wasn't ready. It doesn't. And it makes sense that Wentz in this offense would actually be ready in that standpoint. But how would we, what is it about that that I'm missing with that, you know, from because I'm looking at it from a hindsight point of view where it seems like it fits nicely, but it obviously doesn't.
Well, I think it's not so much what you miss. What you're actually hitting on is the film said exactly what you're saying. The film says, hey, okay. When you look at what Goff is doing in that offense, yeah, he's not doing a lot of things we're going to ask him to do at the NFL level. So how is he going to handle that? And with Wentz, you're saying, yeah, of course, it looks like he's basically running an NFL offense already. But the issues you really run into are sort of the things like, hey, when we interview him and we put him on the board, and one of the things that they love to do, and I love watching them do it, is there are two different things that I think are so valuable that I've seen coaches do. I've never run it when I'm doing the interview. Some teams will put a clip together of all the mistakes from their final year of like college football, throwing as a quarterback, every interception, every ball, that really was just a bad decision. And they'll play one, they'll play it, and they'll say, okay, why was that decision made? They won't rewind it. They won't give him control of the clicker. They just want him to mentally be able to tell them why. And I always remember the story of hearing when Brady Quinn came out of college, and I don't remember if it was the Browns or what team did it, but they put that film on. And not only did, when they said, we're going to play this, he said, oh, so you're going to show this play first. And he knew the order of the plays before they even started the tape, because he in his mind already knew every mistake he had made from his final year of college. And he was able to identify exactly the problem, why he misread it or why the call went one way and he should have done this. He knew all of it. You can, because his memory and his knowledge of what was going on, he was able to literally say, yep, on this play, on the third one you're talking about here against, say, Temple, whatever it may have been, he was like, yep, I missed the check. They aligned like this. I missed it. I didn't call the right protection. They got pressure. So part of it is you get so impressed sometimes when you put these kids on the board, you meet with them, you put them through a workout, they talk with your coaches, talk with the GM. You sometimes get fooled, and I think that's with Goff, not that you're fooled long-term. I think long-term he's going to be fine, and I think he's shown that so far. But I think Goff is such a smart kid. He has a great feel for football. He comes, I believe his dad was either a high school or college coach. So he's known X's nose his whole life. So when they interviewed him, they put him on the board. They did all the different things that coaches try to do to trick these guys to make the mistakes. And bang, he nailed all of them. And I think they're like, we're golden. This kid played a big-time program. His film, while it may be rudimentary, he was phenomenal on film at what he was asked to do. He's great mentally when we interview him. He does everything we ask him when we put him through a workout. This kid's going to be a rock star when we get him on the field. So it's sort of that tough part of what do you put more judgment on, the film that you watch or the interviews that you put him through? Because there are a lot of guys who you've put through interviews that struggle, and then they come into the NFL and they're good. And then the other side were guys that crush the interview process and don't do particularly well. So there's no thing that you missed or that anybody so much could miss. There's always, especially with quarterbacks, going to be a little bit of risk there because you just don't know which guy you're getting. And as you know, you've been doing this a long time, man. The mental jump in having to do things instantaneously in the NFL, whereas in college, the windows are generally bigger. The reaction time of the DBs is slower. So even if you're an instant late with the ball, a lot of time it looks fine on film in college. When that gets to the NFL, that being an instant late can lead to pass breakups and interceptions. And that's what makes that quarterback evaluation so difficult to me, because the mental side is so tough to get a true grasp around.
Yeah, that's, you can ask Baker Mayfield
evaluators about that in terms of what you just described. And that's a perfect example of a kid where you can see some of that coming to fruition right now. And then it's about, can they adjust? And that interview part, it seems to me, is, interviewing, just like evaluation, is an imperfect science. It's a craft. And
100%.
You have to kind of feel for, is this kid telling me what I want to hear? Is the coach telling me what I want to hear? Is there something, and if they're not, is that just because of nerves? Or is it because they're really hiding something? Am I asking the right kind of question and responding to this in a way that is going to, get me the false positive answer that I want? And it's just like, it's such a, that just seems like that's the hardest. That would be equally as hard as evaluating, is just being able to interview people in a manner that makes sense. Cause I mean, it's like the idea of like, even just like the security type of questions, like there's the idea of, I've posed this in the past, is the idea of like, you go to the school and you talk to the recruiting coordinator and you're like, so what's this kid like? And they talk about how good he is in practice. And they talk about, he learns the playbook fast and that he's active in the classroom. Well, what's his social life like? Well, he goes out pretty much every night. And, if you're maybe a younger, inexperienced interviewer or someone who's going to, research, you might take that and go, oh, well, he's a partier and that's it. And then you write down your scouting report. Kid is an active social life, very, goes out every night. And that could mean a lot of things compared to maybe like you say, well, where does he go? And they're like, well, he goes to this club.
Exactly.
And you go to the club and then, one guy might say, talk to a cocktail waitress, and the waitress is like, yeah, he's there every night with three guys and he's here every night. And, he's always hanging out. And you're like, and then you might conclude it there. And then someone else who's really good might say, well, who does he drink? No, he only brings a bottle of water. Well, how long does he stay? He comes in at about 7:45. He stays till about 10, and he just hangs out with his friends. Some girls come by and talk to him. He talks to them. He just leaves with his buddies. He just drinks water. That's all he does. He's probably the most boring guy here. And that's his deal. He just likes to hang out and talk to people and socialize, and then he's gone. And you could have easily, if you didn't have asked those questions, you could have easily labeled the guy immature, a partier, someone who doesn't, who might be trouble when it comes to handling, the limelight of going out socially, when it turns out that he actually has it together in a way that's way more mature than anyone would have expected from a college kid, So, and
100%. Yeah. It's so true. And, I'll bring up a guy you probably remember when he came out, but Jimmy Smith, the corner who's played in the league now about 7 or 8 years, when he came out of Colorado, there were a lot of people, especially in the media, that were saying, oh my God, they took a huge character risk, first round pick, and the guy who's been suspended has been this and that. But when you actually go talk to the school and talk to the coaches, his teammates, he was beloved at school.
Yeah.
And everybody said he's the hardest worker. He's always on time. He's a good guy. He's a good teammate. He just likes to smoke pot.
Yeah.
He's not a bad kid. He never does anything wrong. So the teams that were smart, like Baltimore, said, hey, yeah, the pot may be there, but every other box is checked and checked at a high rate for him being a good teammate, a good person, a guy that's reliable in terms of going to be here. And that's where it takes doing the homework. Just like you were talking about, you have to do your homework to know everything. You can't just take one statement, like you said, he goes out every night. You can't just hear that and say, oh, this guy's a party animal. We got to take him off our board. And I think that's part of what makes the quarterback evaluation tough, because there's so many things that go into it. I think it applies to all positions, but especially quarterback, because while there are other positions where you can be a solid worker and a middle-of-the-road guy, if you're a quarterback and you're not one of the one or two hardest workers on the team, the odds are you're not going to last in the NFL.
Yeah.
And those are the things you have to figure out. You got to figure out what makes a kid tick. How much does he want to be in the NFL? How important is it to him to be a success in the NFL? So many different factors, and I think you nailed it perfectly with your explanation there.
Yeah, and there's so many different types of leaders, because you can have the guys who are in your face and they're yellers and screamers and kind of get after you. And in the moment, you might listen to it as an observer and go, wow, he's harsh as all get out. But in the locker room, you might not know that he cultivates those relationships really well. And at the end of the game, he's like, listen, we're good, right? And wide receiver's like, yeah. He goes, I messed that up. He goes, yeah, we're good. I'm gonna keep targeting you. I'm relying on you, whatever. But on the field, I'm going to get ticked off. Just know that's how I am, and I'm fiery, and that's how I go. Just understand, you know, I want to win just like you want to win, and I know you do. It's just how I react to it, and people can be good with that, you know, whereas someone else might be really quiet, but at the same time, if they're doing the things that they need to do, that they can lead within their own way of doing it, that does get other people to follow, which I think is the big step that it's hard for people to always see. And also kind of poke through from the college level and go, well, there's a different college culture than there is an NFL culture with football. So, you know, how you're going to lead grown men when you're 25 and you've got grizzled veterans who are in their early 30s who've been through some wars and have been to the playoffs and have maybe even won a Super Bowl. How are you going to lead that room compared to a bunch of guys where you're the senior and you've worked your way up? And I think that those are things that can be also make that acclimation time probably difficult, you know, because you hear the story about Frank Gore, even as a running back, where like when he came to that 49ers organization, there's a story that at the end of a loss, there were a lot of those guys post TO era who were like, let's go out, let's go have some fun. They're laughing and joking. And rookie Frank Gore was like yelling, screaming, and crying in the locker room over the loss, and more so over the fact that these guys didn't seem to care about football in the way that he thought they should. And that was his reaction as a rookie in a way that you would look and go, you wouldn't expect that, and especially from the position as well. So
no question.
Yeah.
But it's a great point, because especially the leadership part, it's so hard to quantify, because the coach can tell you one thing, but you need to find out what it's like in the locker room. And that's a hard thing to get a feel for, because the coaches aren't in there. That's sort of a sanctuary.
Yeah.
And trying to find out from the players, and sometimes you have to go to the equipment guys. They're in there more than pretty much anybody else. They get a feel for which guys are really the leaders. And I can still remember, I don't remember the player we were interviewing, but I remember at the Browns, we were interviewing, I want to say he was an All-American, either O-line or D-line at Iowa. And we were interviewing him, trying to get a feel for his leadership and the rest of the team. And I remember saying to him, so, okay, who's the leader? Are you the leader of your position, or who's the leader? And he said to me, hey, he said, there's only one leader at the Iowa Hawkeyes. And he said, it's that little midget playing safety, Bob Sanders. He said, he's in charge of that room. He said, everything Bob says is what we do. He said, we will follow Bob to the end of the world. And I was like, okay. I think it was a guard. And I was like, all right. So a guard just told me they're listening to a 5'8 safety over anybody else on the team. I said, that tells me all I need to know about that safety, that guy's a guy I want on my team and in the foxhole with me.
Yeah, that's a great story, and that makes total sense. You know, we were talking a little bit before the show and talking about some of the questions that we wanted to discuss today. And one of those was, you mentioned offensive line play about this, and it was, you know, is there a position recently where you've learned something that was really been meaningful to your evaluation process, and you know, something that you've looked at, you know, after years of doing it, that you look at and go, wow, you know, I hadn't really thought about it from that perspective, and that's going to be really helpful to what I do moving forward.
You know, 100%. I mean, and you keep learning in this business. I mean, I've been in this business since 94 when I was a gopher at the Rams, and I've been in it for years and worked for some really good scouts and under some people that I really respected, both coaching and scouting. And they always taught me about, hey, when I'm watching offensive tackle, see how he shuffles his feet. Can he bend his knees and block with base? And does he shoot his hands? Does he punch? And if he's not a violent puncher, does he at least get a fit and hold on to the guy with both hands between the chest plate? And if he loses his grip, does he shoot his hands back again? So I was like, okay. So I had always gone with sort of the approach of, hey, I want a guy who can sit down. I want a guy who shoots those hands and gets a fit and shoots him again if he loses it. And then I'm at an NFL training camp when I was working in the CFL, and there's a veteran CFL scout who actually is now with the XFL named John Peterson, bounced around the NFL and XFL and CFL for the last 30 years. And we're watching film, and he goes, and he pauses. He goes, man, he goes, do you see that tackle? And I said, no, what is it? And he said that his favorite thing watching a tackle, and mind you, I've been doing this almost 20 years at this time. He said, look at him. He goes, he's sliding. He shoots his hands. He punches him, and he pulls his hands back. And instead of shooting them both back to get him, he shoots his outside hand to the shoulder. And he said he shoots his inside hand violently at the guy's hip so he can get his thumb right on the hip and he can get a good grip. And he said if he gets that grip and can lock in, he said that inside move is now gone for the pass rusher. And he said most of the time because you're controlling that hip, you can ride him right up the field. I had never been taught that in all my years. There are many things I thought I knew about it, but about pass blockers and offensive line grading, but that thing changed the way I grade line because instantly I was like, wow. I was like, I can take a guy who doesn't use his hands violently, but knows how to position that bottom hand right after contact, and he can literally be a better guy use of hands than a guy who constantly shoots those hands trying to punch. It was a great lesson to learn, and I think since then it's also made me much better at evaluating the guys in terms of their ability to maintain a pass protection, because once you get that hand locked on the hip, maintaining becomes so much easier because he can't make a move without you knowing what's coming because you can feel his hip move. So as soon as he tries to brace and come back in, you know it's coming. You can slide back in and re-anchor and shove that hand further into his hip. So that was a lesson I learned. Never thought of it before that. And since then, it's one of the primary things I look at on all offensive tackles. And it doesn't mean you eliminate them if they can't do it, but it's just something you write down that says, hey, they don't know to do this yet. We need to see if he can instinctively use his two hands separately to do two different things in order to be successful. Because some guys, it's very hard to get them to do different things with their hands. They've been so trained to do it at the same time that getting them to go one high and one low can be literally something that's like a fish out of water. So it's something, if you don't see it on film, you really got to find out if they can do it.
Yeah, that sounds great. It's kind of like the equivalent of like teaching a kid how to pat their head and rub their stomach at the same time.
Exactly.
But it's, and watching them struggle or they actually get it right away. It's funny because it's like you think about patterns from that perspective, and it's one of those things where, you know, really – I think for wide receiver, there's some things that I've learned because I've been watching some podcasts and some YouTube videos of former Rutgers assistant wide receiver coach Drew Lieberman, who also works with Mohamed Sanu and has worked with Jay Sternberger recently, as well as Juwan Winfrey, who recently made the Broncos roster. And he puts out these fantastic videos breaking down techniques for wide receiver. And you know, I've always like looked at like coaches talking about the wide receiver play, especially with releases and different types of release and break patterns that are used. And I found that I was far too rigid with my application of how I define those things and what to use with it, when there's a lot more creativity with that position within a structure. And so there's a lot more kind of the great wide receivers improvise, but they know how to hit their marks within that structure to be reliable, to be at the depth they need to be and be, you know, and break at the point that they need to in the space they need to for the quarterback to hit them with anticipation. But in between that, like the different types of releases based on where the cornerback is placed and then how they might, like what he calls stealing a release, which is, you know, on a run play, is he doing something to try and see if a cornerback's going to react to him so he can set that up later? And what type of, you know, that the various types of footwork that's out there that sometimes I mistakenly looked at and said, thought to myself, that's not really a complete release type of form, and come to find out that, yeah, actually that is. And that is, you know, a one step hesitation is not an incomplete thing. You know, it's actually a very worthwhile thing, and it's different than a rocker step. And, you know, and then there are different types of things that you do in terms of in zone routes also, where maybe how you gain depth and you turn your head and your eyes on certain types of routes in zone against where the leverage of the cornerback is. So, I mean, I've literally this past year, I've filled up, I've created like a big blackboard on a wall here, and I've literally filled up that wall with notes of how I'm going to basically redo how I evaluate the position in terms of defining factors. And a lot of the stuff's things I knew, but I didn't know how to really apply it well in terms of how to watch for it. And then there were things that I just completely didn't know at all, you know, when it comes to some of those things with releases and break types and what works better for zone, what works better for certain types of leverage. So, you know, I can't wait to like actually start really formulating all of that so that for the 2021 season, as I really apply that, and like I'm applying it now to a degree when I'm looking at certain things, but really getting it firmly defined so that when I head into the 2021 season and beyond, that I have all of this kind of really written down and solidified as criteria and how I want to weigh it and grade it. So it's always I always feel like I'm 1 to 2 years or 3 years behind where I want to be when it comes to my publication and what I want to do with it. But it's just part of the process.
Well, it takes you a while, right? You're trying to incorporate something new. You've been doing it a way. You have to incorporate sort of new things you're going to do when you're taking notes. I mean, and with receivers, to me, that's one of the most difficult positions to get all the nuances, because when you take out the truly special guys, the one or two or three guys a year, and then the complete rejects, the guys in that middle range, there are a lot of similar players. And of them, 20% have a real career, and the rest of them wash out of football.
Yeah.
So what are the little things that help separate them? And things like that, like you're talking about, do they know how to release differently versus different coverages? And do they identify the different coverages? One of the things I was taught really early was when you go to a workout and you see a guy who runs all great routes, he goes, you better go back and watch the film and see if when he runs those same routes, does he give those routes away in games? Because in a workout, you're not really paying attention to, is he doing something that gives it away to where a corner's reading it? But when you watch him in a game and every time he runs what looks like a great route, the guy's right on his hip.
Yeah.
It tells you that there's some type of tell. And that's why certain guys, I'll trade a little bit, like Keenan Allen. He can't run. He's a 4'6", 4'6", 5 guy. But you don't know what he's running until the moment he sticks that foot in the ground to cut.
Yeah.
And that's, like you're talking about with the release, that ability to maintain that route integrity was something it took me a long time to sort of get a feel for. And it takes a few years to sort of incorporate it into your grading, to get better at grading it to where you feel comfortable saying, yep, now this is a big part of my evaluation bubble. Yeah. That becomes a big part of it. And that release thing is huge.
Yeah. There's a lot like that whole, and there's all a little bit of kind of like a boxing thing with that, because I was listening this morning to like Teddy Atlas talk about Mike Tyson, and he has this great podcast and episode where he's a guest on Joe Rogan's show. And he's talking about how you just don't really know how good someone is until they face adversity. And that, you know, Mike Tyson, in his opinion, was, you know, maybe he didn't know the exact record, but he said maybe he was 50-6. He goes, but he was 0-6 in the fights that meant the most, where someone actually took it to him back, and he wasn't just some monster truck running over a Volkswagen. And so he was talking about that. And I think about wide receiver play, and you see what happens when your first, when your main move doesn't work. And you see it so often in college where guys, their first move, it doesn't work against a top corner, and they just don't have an answer. It's just that for the next three quarters, it's like they're just using the same move over and over again, or they try a different move, but because they haven't really developed one, a secondary move or a counter or any type of strategy, it's rough, and they stumble, or they don't look good, and they're not ready. And so, yeah, I mean, to me, it's like, I want to see what, that's part of it too, is being able to see not just what they do well, you know, for a few reps, and they say, well, I've got that down, but what happens when someone stops them? Can they counter and create in the moment and do it in a way that's still going to get them open on time at the right depth? And that's, you know, obviously we're talking about more, maybe even special players, but even like functional NFL starters who, you know, you may not look at and say they're superstars, you know, they learn to do that eventually with a lot of play. You know, it may not be.
Oh, no question.
Yeah. So.
And I think the other thing to remember, and this is something I think that gets sort of lost by maybe the fans or the media, whatever, is the fifth receiver on an NFL team is a truly great receiver.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't stick around maybe for a year because the team drafts you and they think you got something and they find out they're wrong and they cut you. But a guy that lasts 4, 5, 6 years and is a backup, he's really good. He knows exactly what he's doing most of the time. He's very polishing, not everything, but he's polishing many things. And you talk about the ability to learn a second move or a second use of hands to get off the line. How many times do you see these great athletes in college at receiver get overdrafted because they're freaks of nature, but they have no clue what they're doing in terms of hand use? And if they can't just beat you off the line with their quickness, they're literally done. And then it becomes a matter of, are you going to draft a guy based on just that pure athletic ability, hoping he can improve in not just areas that he has to improve to be a little better, but improve in areas that are vital to even being an adequate player on the roster? And that, to me, is one of the myths and questions on receivers, is how teams take these great athletes who are so raw in everything they do and hope they're going to learn at the highest level that they can improve on all those areas that, like I said, are not just important to be an okay player. They're vital to just making a roster.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I'm probably oversimplifying the illustration of that, but like, to me, it was kind of like Marquise Lee versus Robert Woods. Like, I absolutely loved Robert Woods for the reasons that you're talking about in terms of what he could do, whereas Marquise Lee, I had numerous questions about what he could do technically. And you know, Marquise Lee certainly still has shown up till recently that there was, you see the enticing, potential there. But with Woods was a guy that you look at and, I was talking with Mark Schofield last week, and we're talking about just the hypothetical question of if you could pick any wide receiver in the league to build a team around, who would you pick? And, you know, I think Mark was expecting me to talk about a really technically great receiver who may not be like a great athlete. And I said Tyreek Hill, because he scares the bejesus out of coverage in terms of his ability to wreck coverage with his speed, and that he's on his way to maybe at least being in the same city or town or zip code as Steve Smith, not on the same street, but like somewhere in that range, because I felt like the way that the league looks at wide receivers, I feel like I might be able to sneak away with a Robert Woods, and be able to.
There's no question.
And I think that's what the Rams did.
100%. And I think a lot of that just comes down to the enticement of, I can find guys, not so much that are as good as Robert Woods as an all-around receiver, but that are as good at Robert Woods at taking small plays and turning them into touchdowns.
Yes.
So they say, okay, if I can find a lot of guys that have that same ability to make game-changing plays, I'll pass on a guy like Woods till the third or fourth round, because I'll take a gamble on a guy that, if everything checks out right, can change games, can be a guy that instantly, two plays a game, can go from 0-0 to 14-0 because he's so special athletically. And I understand that. It's important to have dynamic players. But I tell you what, when you have guys like Woods and guys like Keenan Allen, they just churn and churn and make play after play, and they may not take it to the house, but those are the guys, to me, that I want, that I feel more comfortable with starting than guys that maybe are a little bit inconsistent and don't do the things. I'm not saying Tariq Hill's in that class.
No, absolutely.
Tariq Hill is special talent-wise, but there are so many guys that are freak athletes that don't have the things that Woods does. And Woods, to me, is a simple guy. Not simple in terms of anything negative. Just, he's an easy guy to evaluate. The routes are great.
Yeah.
The hands are natural. He does everything technically sound. Hey, I want that guy as my number two.
Yeah.
Because I know I can throw it to him every single time. It's tight coverage. He's going to find a way to create a little bit of space and be open and have his hands in the right spot, and the ball's going to be there. But I think they get overlooked, just like you said, and it's not an uncommon thing. But I think, unfortunately, those players like Woods that you were talking about, it's tough. They're great players, but they don't get that pub.
Yeah, yeah, and I agree 100% with that. You know, moving forward with that, let's talk about some players that were following in the NFL, maybe because of something about them that we had questions about when we were studying them. I'll lead off with a guy. One of the guys that I'm really kind of wanting to keep a close eye on is Devin Singletary, the Bills running back, because, a lot of people really seemed high on him in the media coming out. And when I watched him, I'm not like a strictly by the metrics type of guy. Like, I like to have certain thresholds for positions and ranges. And I think that there's some sort of compensatory way of, like, if you look at a player who's not extremely fast at a certain position, well, again, like you talked about with Woods, is he someone that can still, he can get separation, but what else can he do that helps you understand where he wins and what he does well and how you can pick him as a team, and get him to work. And I look at Singletary, and what I saw was, okay, He's short. He's kind of small for the position. He's slow. He times slow. He doesn't time quick. So, you know, I'm thinking about, I look at all this and I think, well, what could compensate for him? And what I can see is he has really good processing speed mentally. And he understands how to use his feet well to create solutions within the scheme that he's running behind. And so there's a real intelligence and technical facility with how he paces his footwork, how he adjusts the stride, how he uses his feet to set up defenders. And he sees developing blocks and defenders and within the scheme very well. So I thought, well, if there's a way for him to be successful as a ball carrier in the NFL, it's going to be because he has tremendous vision and his feet are integrated with that in a way that he plays quicker than his time says. But I'm still skeptical because I've never graded a player at this point in the 15 years I've been doing this who just metrically from the workouts really underwhelmed to the level that he did. And when I saw him on the field, I could see also that I'm trying to project him towards the next level. And I just felt like I'm worried he's too slow. He's too small. He's not quick enough that what he does in the college level is great, but in the NFL, it just might make him a contributor at best, as opposed to, you know, a starter that you can lean on. And so far, there's lots of nice talk about him, but when I watch him in the games, I'm like, I'm still not sure whether the hole just closed before he got there because of his lack of athletic ability or because he's still acclimating and maybe he's thinking a little bit on a slower level, so he's a step slow, or the hole just closed up sooner and it didn't matter whether it was Singletary, Frank Gore, or LeSean McCoy, you know? And so I have to watch him more.
And you know, I think you make a great point because you bring up the metrics, and I think the advent or the advancement of the analytics has led to NFL teams even being able to study more and more. And one of the things that I find so funny is, for my first, say, 8 or 10 years in the league, what I kept hearing from the old timers is, if a guy is short and he's not explosive, he ain't going to make it. And now with all the metrics, people are that one of the things that is held true, as opposed to many of things that have sort of been thrown by the wayside because of metrics saying, hey, you go for it on fourth down and different things like that, is all the metrics say, yeah, if a running back or receiver is under 5'9 and he's not really explosive in the vertical and the 40, they usually fail. And I'm thinking, yeah, I've been getting told that by guys who don't even know how to work a calculator. Because in general, running backs and receivers who are short have to be special in terms of explosiveness. And maybe their 40 time may not be great, but if their 40's slow, they better have a really good 10 time and a really good vertical, because they're going to have to get through holes fast because they don't have the size to be able to run through contact. So Singletary to me is a great example of, is he going to be the outlier who makes it, or is he going to be that guy that 2 years from now we say, yeah, gee, really thought he hoped he could have been more than what he was, but yeah, he's out of the league like so many other 5'8 guys that run in the high 4.5s, low 4.6s that are sort of thought of as not good enough. And it's funny because the past 6 years, I spent most of my time grading CFL prospects, so I didn't really grind on a lot of the first-round picks. And then this summer, when I said, you know what, I really want to start looking at next year's NFL draft class, now that I'm back doing media work, I started on Iowa, because I always like to start with Big Ten film, and I started looking at their two tight ends, because I wanted to take a look at the Hockenson kid, Noah Fant, get a feel for them. And to me, in the first 3 games I did, it was like, okay, Hockenson, I get, that's a first-round pick. Fant, to me, was, why is this guy in the first 3 rounds? I didn't see it. Mm-hmm. I saw a guy that was stiff, robotic, mm-hmm. didn't know how to get out of his breaks. He often looked lost running his rounds. Mm-hmm. And I get that when he tested like a champ. And the people in Iowa have told me he's a good kid and he's going to do everything you ask and all that. But when I watch the film, I just don't see it. And I know that he's made one or two plays this year for Denver where he just caught it and ran. And yes, I know we can do that. But I got to tell you, I have real doubts as to whether he can really be a complete tight end, because he can't be an inline guy. Yeah. I mean, he's not that guy. And when I see him outside split out, when I saw it at Iowa, I saw a guy that like burst off the ball, was tight in the hips, upright in his routes. He really looked very robotic and sort of mechanical trying to do things. And I mean, hey, I hope he does well. I always root for the Iowa guys because I know they're good kids and they won't make it through that program if they're not. But he makes me really wonder if he even has a future as a guy that's going to really be a contributor, maybe as a second or a third tight end. But as a first tight end, I really wonder if he's got a future in the NFL.
And I can understand that. It's funny that I had a similar story about him because I watched him and I watched Hawkinson, and I have a friend who's close to that program who's had had some experience in a variety of settings in football, and he just as a matter of just fun, he contacted me one day and said, "Have you watched the Iowa tight ends yet? I don't want to say anything. I just want to know what you think." And I said, you know, everyone's like all on Fant, but he fights the ball. Like, he fights the ball almost every time, and he doesn't seem. And the bad part of it is that oftentimes the technique's good, but he's still fighting the ball. So I'm worried about how he tracks it, how he looks it in. You know, and that it, but if that technique is still like good, but it's a roller coaster with him catching it, I'm a little curious. This Hawkinson guy looks fantastic, you know, and certainly, you know, Hawkinson early on has dropped a number of possible touchdowns, but they've been some difficult throws or throws that I think that within the next year or two, we're going to see him catch and people will be lauding him as a potential Pro Bowl player. Whereas I think with Fant, yeah, I mean, everything you said, I completely agree with and can understand where I look at him and go, it seems to me like he's what I think people saw Darren Waller possibly being for the Raiders, but you know, Waller is actually a more fluid, refined athlete who is making good on, you know, his transition, at least as a pass catcher. And
exactly,
you know, and when you look at Fant, I'm looking at that and go, yeah, you want to use him as a receiver, but is it going to be there? So I get that. I completely get that with him. You know, I think who's another player for you that kind of fits that bill for you?
You know, the one other guy that really jumped out at me this year, because I did all the quarterbacks because that's sort of my thing. I want to get a feel for him, is the Drew Locke kid from Missouri, because everybody you talk to at the school, good kid, hard worker, does all that stuff, tremendous athlete. I mean, this kid that could have had a basketball scholarship to Montana. I mean, he athletically is what you want, big arm, quick release. I mean, and at the Senior Bowl, although he was inconsistent, you could see the physical tools jump out. But when I'm watching in games, it literally looked like I was watching two different players. You had a guy that for the first half, maybe first three quarters, he was on time. Everything was easy, looked comfortable. But as soon as things started getting tight and games were close, or they were behind in the fourth quarter, and the team basically threw it on his shoulders and said, all right, we need you to carry us, it just seemed to go to heck. He looked like he was getting nervous in the pocket. He would hold the ball a little bit extra tight. When it would come out, it didn't have the same accuracy. He wasn't showing the same timing. It's just one of those things where almost every game you saw, at least that I graded, I saw him when it was important time. I'd say the majority of those important plays, he didn't come through on. Whereas the early parts of the game, and when there wasn't a ton of pressure on him, he looked really good. And most quarterbacks who, at least in the years I've done this, that I've seen that with, have not, who have acted like that in games in college, don't turn out to be successful in the NFL. And the reality is they got a value that he was a second-round pick. They didn't have to use a first-rounder on him, so that's great. But I just wonder if really it's ever going to come to fruition for this kid, just because I never saw him consistently do it when he was being pressured in key situations. And if you can't do that, if you can't make plays when the opponent has got you pinned and they know what's coming, if you can't figure out a way to make that play, it's going to be really hard to be successful long-term in the NFL.
Yeah, and it's funny because in a related way, watching him as well, the kind of way I put it, and it's somewhat related, is that he seemed like this guy who, from a technique standpoint, in terms of knowing what you're supposed to do, in terms of your drops, in terms of making sure that your footwork is kind of sharp and making sure that you're, you know, stepping through your throws and really doing complete processes, not robotically, but at least in a way that is repeatable, creates repeatable accuracy, you know, for what you do, and it's efficient enough. And watching him, you know, when he's playing easier opponents and he's playing early and it's successful, he's kind of loose with everything that he does. It's not really, you know, you don't see the follow through. You see kind of the sloppier drops. You kind of see this type of stuff. And then what I would see is that, like, he'd face the Alabamas of the world or the Florida, and you'd see him try to do the right things that he knows that he's supposed to have done, and it just doesn't work for him. It's like someone telling the kid in class to, like, shape up and do it, you know, do it the way that I've taught you, and then they try to do it and they flub the answer. But you know they're extremely smart, you know they're extremely talented, but that because they haven't done their homework, because they haven't practiced the way that you ask them to practice, when it's time to actually have to rely on that stuff, it just wasn't there for me. And it was like watching that was very telling to me, because it just seemed like a precocious kid who, like, you know, has the goods on a certain level, but it doesn't matter because he's squandered the things that are going to keep his game tight when he needs it the most and when he needs to draw on it the most. And that kind of concerned me about him. So I'm kind of looking forward to seeing if that develops and if he's figured that part out, you know, now that he's in the NFL.
The only negative he has going for him is it seems like any quarterback selected by Elway turns into a failure. So it doesn't bode for him that Elway, the great quarterback himself, said this guy's the guy, because, whew, man, that track record is looking awfully bad. Makes you wonder if Denver would have ever won anything if he couldn't have convinced Manning to come out there.
Yeah, very, very, very true. You know, I think my second player is another running back, because it's just somebody that one of my contributors, Jay Moyer, brought up. Jay's studying to be a surgeon, and he used to be a high school coach who really focused in on the run game for about 7 years. He worked a lot with offensive line and running backs. And the guy that we both were kind of had questions about was Miles Sanders, the Philadelphia running back, because you watched him in his games, and besides the fact that his ball security was awful in terms of his track record of fumbles, I mean, it was lower. I think it was lower than Sony Michel's was coming out, which was pretty bad. And Michel corrected his, but what was concerning to me was that Sanders, oftentimes you saw good ball security in terms of his form, but he still fumbled the ball, which to me is like, what's going to happen? But then on top of that was just the decision-making. You often see with running backs, they're the most athletic guys on the field. Are they going to bounce plays outside very, you know, at every opportunity? Do they actually read the line of scrimmage well and understand their blocking scheme and what they should be anticipating when they see a flash of a defender, you know, working across the shoulder or their hips getting inside of a block, and how you adjust to that and what the next hole is and how your footwork should line up with all of it. And just watching him right now, it's just like, it just seems like he bounces everything. And Jay had this really great example of a gap play where basically he follows his guard towards the crease, sees a flash, and it's like if the road was this wide open road in the middle of town and there's a green light that just kind of comes on, that's like green enough that like it basically almost blinds you, you know, he like jumped out of the way onto the sidewalk, you know, as opposed to like going down the road. It was just, and you see that repeatedly with him. And I'm curious to whether he's going to go the route of a guy like Darren McFadden or CJ Spiller, who were guys that just never could process quickly enough despite great athletic ability. Or is he going to go the route of a guy like LeSean McCoy, who, you know, or even Reggie Bush to a degree, where you could say, you know, both were really, really good runners in college, but occasionally would have bouts of, I'm the best athlete. I'm going to react to trying to just get outside of everybody. And then they refine their games to where they become very good inside runners. And I'm just, you know, to me, this is kind of a 50-50 scenario if I were just eyeballing it, where I wonder, you know, how successful Miles Sanders is actually going to be if he's missing some of these creases as wildly as he has thus far.
You know, it's funny you bring that up as sort of the question, not so much I didn't grade Sanders, but the guy that's been successful, but not, in my opinion, especially NFL, is Melvin Gordon.
Yeah.
And when he was coming out of Wisconsin, I loved a lot of things about him. But the one thing that bothered me was I kept hearing great instincts, great vision. But the number of times that he ran into his blocker's back or hit their hip in college, I kept thinking, geez, this is Wisconsin. Those holes are as big as my house. Yeah. What's going on? And I just had this inkling. I mean, I hadn't graded him when he was coming out because I was in the CFL, but I had taken a lot of notes just watching Wisconsin guys that might be considered for the CFL. And then he goes to the Chargers, which is a team I follow in the NFL. And I've watched this guy over 4.5 years now, and he still has the same issue. And I really wonder if he's one of those guys, because you mentioned Sanders being usually the best athlete on the field. Gordon's a tremendous athlete, and when he gets a hole, he can explode through it like nobody's business. But I see that same thing. I wonder if he can see it and feel it and has that natural awareness. So I totally understand your concern on Sanders, because if a guy doesn't have it when you grade the film on him, I've very rarely have seen a running back all of a sudden acquire that skill. It seems to be that's either you have that spatial awareness, that instinct, that feel for where the hole's going to open up and where the blocker's going to make his block, or you don't.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's a teachable thing. And I tell you what, like I said, I didn't look at Sanders, but if you're seeing that, I would be nervous as heck if I'm the Eagles saying, oh my God, we might have a guy who can't find a hole on his own.
Yeah, and on a gap play where there's just one option most of the time.
Yeah.
But, you know, exactly. And that's the scary part, because like McFadden, you knew, put him in a gap offense, he's going to be a 1,000-yard player. Even when he earned 1,000 yards with that great Cowboys line and it was a zone offense for the most part, you could still show tape of him literally looking like he was stopping to ask for directions in the middle of the hole.
100%.
Yep. Yeah. It was just crazy. But like when you have the fill in the blank, I always call like gap plays fill in the blank, and like zone plays multiple choice. And if you're a fill in the blank, if you're getting a fill in the blank offense, and you can't fill that blank, that's a scary thing. So,
yeah, it's a great way to break it down, too. That's a great description, because I think a lot of people don't realize how certain offenses, there is no choice. There isn't really no instinct or vision necessary. Here's the hole.
Yeah.
Either you run it into the open hole, or if the hole ain't there, we may want you to still run it in there because it's the only option anyway,
right,
and try to get a yard out of it. Whereas when you have choices, and I think that's a great way, that's something for young people. If you want to go online, look that up, because Matt makes an amazing point here. If you're learning to grade running backs, you have to understand when he has an opportunity to find options, more holes than one, or is it a one-hole play? Because if it's a one-hole play, you have to understand that, because if he can't find it, that should be red flags, fire, watch out, because this guy's going to really struggle at the NFL level.
Yeah, and if you want to look something up, I'd recommend Chad Spann, ChadSpannRSP, where he wrote about the difference between running gap and zone plays. And he's a high school coach right now. He's a former NFL and CFL player. And played at Northern Illinois.
I graded him. I remember him.
Yeah. Yeah. He owned the touchdown record, for the single, he led the NCAA in touchdowns the year that Cam Newton won the Heisman. So he had injuries and things happened, but he certainly, he did a really good job writing that up. So I definitely recommend that. Who are some players when we get to end this show let's talk about a couple of players each that we've been watching that for the 2020 draft and beyond.
You know, one of the guys that I've looked at, and I don't think I've mentioned him before in our calls or our podcast, is when I was grading Indiana this year, they have an offensive lineman named Croy Kronk.
Huh.
And he is this was going to be his fourth full season as a starter. And then in their fourth game, he broke his leg. He's a senior. And I don't know if he's going to redshirt. I think he'll probably decide that based on what he hears from the NFL committee, because he has one more year of eligibility if he wants to go back. But when I watch this kid play, and I don't think he's a special player in any area. I don't think he's a great athlete. I don't think he's particularly giant size. But when I watch him, he checks every box as good solid, which is good size, decent flexibility, great hand use, good technique, good focus, good concentration. Everything he does is good. And I look at that and say, gosh, there's not a lot of guys in the NFL that are playing tackle that I can say that's good about everything. A lot of them, I may say great athlete or really good feet, but terrible toughness, can't play with leverage. This guy checks every box. I don't think he's a really good athlete. I think he's good enough. I think he's a guy that if he comes out this year or decides to stay in the year, I could see him being that, say, fourth, fifth round pick that ends up working his way into the starting lineup as a rookie and plays a long time in the NFL. There's something about this kid when I watch him. He just reminds me of a guy that's going to get overlooked and play in the league for a long time because he does everything solidly. He's not special, but just solid. And that's something that I'm sure you've seen it a lot, Matt. I know I've seen it for years, is sometimes solid, you can overlook it because you want to find the superstar. But sometimes those guys that have no weaknesses and they check every single box turn out to be better than the guys that may be better athletes, but don't check every single box.
Yeah, that's a great point. And a guy last night who, or for this season, in a, for a needy team in terms of their offensive skill players in New England, is Brandon Bolden, Ole Miss running back, who, you know, he helps on special teams. If you need him to go deep as a receiver, he can catch the ball deep. He can get you the tough yards. He's someone that is pretty versatile in terms of what you need him to do in the scheme. He's not a superstar athlete, but he's been around forever, and he's outlasted a lot of first and second day running back picks and free agents that they've had in over the years, and he's still there and still making plays when they need him. Another guy who kind of reminds me of him in a sense, mainly just because they have the Ole Miss connection, is a running back by the name of Scotty Phillips. He's 5'8", 211. And he might be the best blocking, pass protecting running back I've seen this year. You know, he's very astute in being able to deliver a punch. He understands how to roll through his hips and get good position so that he's not dropping his head. He's not overextending, and he'll take on bigger guys that way and does some of the dirty work that way. And he can run gap or zone. He runs more of a gap scheme. But he's someone that I think has pretty good footwork. I think he processes the field well. And that low center of gravity, you know, he's someone that can push a pile, get under hits, and get yards through contact that I like. And he's a guy that I don't see him starting for an NFL team ever, but I could see him, like a Brandon Bolden, winding up on a team for a while. And if he doesn't wind up on a team for a while in the NFL, because it's often a very talent-rich environment for a lot of running backs with few positions, I could see him playing perhaps in the CFL and being a guy that could be productive as a contributor or a starter possibly, depending on the fit in terms of what they're looking for.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, you know, there are a lot of running backs that I think could have made it in the NFL, but they get cut once or twice and they didn't really get a chance to sort of shine, like in terms of have one or two big preseason games. So when they get cut that second time, they're never heard from again. They come up to the CFL and they kill it.
Yeah.
The Montreal Alouettes have a guy named William Standback, was a dominant small school runner in college. He's up there now in the middle of his first 1,000-yard season. He's a great player. Now, he could, no doubt, he can be in the NFL as a backup tailback talent-wise. But there are a lot of guys like that that, because of the position, and if you don't happen to have that one game or even one quarter in a preseason game and you just don't win that numbers battle the first year, sometimes you never even get that other opportunity because that's such a position where you can find guys so easily that sometimes better players slip through the cracks because they didn't blow it up that one time they had a chance and poof, they're gone and they're playing in the CFL or now even the XFL.
Yeah, absolutely. So who's your second guy on your list?
Okay, the second guy is sort of a disappointment. I threw on the University of Minnesota film. I was very excited to take a look at their team. I also wanted to take a look at their sophomore right tackle because he's the largest man in college football at 6'9", 400 pounds. I mean, that alone made me just want to take a peek at him. But they have a receiver, senior number 6, Johnson, who I've been hearing a lot of hype about this whole offseason. And people talking about this kid potentially being a first-round pick and possibly challenging to be in that mix with the two Alabama receivers and the kid from Colorado as maybe the first receiver. So I thought in the film, I'm all excited to watch this kid. And I got to tell you, I couldn't have been more disappointed. I mean, I understand he really does make some spectacular catches. I mean, his ability to win contested battles, his feel for what's going on in terms of body positioning and understanding where the defender is outstanding. But literally, I was watching him, and I was so disappointed in his speed. And I don't mean his 40 time. I just mean his playing speed. He looked so slow off the ball and so slow in his routes. I literally texted everybody I know in the NFL and said, hey, did Minnesota have their kids run in the spring for the combine scouts? Because most college teams, their guys run for the combine scouts, so they have a sort of a preliminary 40. And every one of them got back and he said, nope, he didn't, that not him, but the school, Minnesota, didn't have them run. And every one of them said, yep, we have him estimated as in the 4.6s to 4.7s because we don't think he can run. I said, yep. I said, there's something missing here. And I said, I hate to say it because everything I've heard is phenomenal young man, hard worker, leader, team captain, competitive blocker. But geez, when I watch him, it's not just Keenan Allen where he's got a little bit of quickness but no burst. Or even you talked about Robert Woods, who's got a little bit of juice, but not special juice. I don't see any juice on this kid. I mean, he looks slow, and I can't figure out. I kept watching game, and then I said, oh, I'll watch another game. I'll watch another game. And then after I got done with the big games this year and I wasn't even impressed, I said, you know, I'm going to go pull some 2018 film because maybe he's hurt. Maybe I'm missing something. And I watched two games from 2018. I still don't see it. So either I'm missing it completely or this guy just can't move. And if that's the case, I don't see him having much of an NFL future. He was really disappointing.
Yeah, I can understand that. That's, you know, that's, and that's the way it often is. It's interesting how that works out because there are guys you see all that hype and then you see some of the plays they make. But then when you watch him, it's just like when that athletic threshold isn't met, it's just, yeah, that's tough. There's a guy I'll look that I'm looking at who's a tight end out of North Carolina by the name of Carl Tucker, who I'm intrigued by him because he's about 6'2", 255. He's someone that has the ability to punch and roll through the contact. Obviously he does well as a shield blocker on the backside and then works into routes as more of an H-back type of player. But he's someone that I think that he, because he does execute a lot of blocks with good technique, and he has quick feet to move laterally. I think there's some promise there. He's quick to the attack point. I think he works across formations well to deliver that first punch on the weak side linebacker, the strong side linebacker, and even working across the field. You see, again, the good punching form that's there, and he has those active hands and feet when stalk blocking. So he's good at being able to work downfield. And he's someone that transitions well from block to block, whether he's double teaming or combo blocking. And he does a good job as a receiver. I mean, he comes off low from the line. He can get under the pads of defenders. As a run blocker, he can do that against defensive ends and push him, get a push and when man to head up on a guy. And I think that this is a guy that was considered, at least in college, the number 22 athlete in the country when he came out heading to North Carolina, and they said that he ran 22 miles an hour in practice. Well, you know, that's interesting, but I'm interested to, but I did see some burst out of him that was intriguing. And he's someone that can pluck the ball pretty well. And he's fluid as a receiver. I just want to see him get better in terms of his hand usage as a blocker. He can get his hands a little too high, on defenders. And I also think that he can overrun some assignments as a lead blocker. So I want to see how good of a feel he has for angles on a consistent basis. And a lot of the routes that I saw thus far are mostly like breaking to the flats or up the seam, and there wasn't a lot of nuance to his breaks on routes. I want to see a little more suddenness to see if he can maximize the suddenness of what his athletic ability is about. So I've only watched him a little bit thus far, so I want to see more. But because of the fact that he's missed a lot of time with injuries, he had an undisclosed injury and that cost him 8 games in 2017, and he had an arm injury during like 2016 practice that cost him a lot of time. So I'm wondering if this is a guy that could be a kind of a late developer who could end up, you know, contributing for a team and some of the size is there that you're looking for in terms of the strength. And I think certainly the ability, the raw ability to catch and the block, there's a lot there to like. I'm just curious to see how much more refined it is heading into his senior year.
And also, I'll tell you what, when you talk about what you're describing. I haven't seen him play. When you're describing a kid who's athletic, good lateral quickness, can catch the ball, and is a good willing blocker, that's a guy that you look at and say, okay, he can be in line. He can be an H that moves. He might be able to do fullback stuff. And if he's athletic enough, not that we're going to make him a slot receiver, but at least in certain schemes, we can motion him out and run him in routes out of the slot position. A guy with that type of versatility is so valuable in today's NFL because he can literally be number two tight end, maybe your number two or three emergency fullback if your team still uses a fullback. He can be an H move guy if you want to use two tight ends so you can be a blocker. And he's a guy that you can move around to create mismatches and to get a blocker out in space when you motion him across the line and throw that quick receiver screen. And he's just coming out and smashing that defender. I mean, guys like that have value, guys that can be used in a variety of roles on offense. So I'm looking forward to checking him out. Sounds like a very intriguing player for today's NFL.
Yeah, and I think what you brought up in terms of fit is perfect. I mean, a great example of that would be Derek Carrier out of Oakland, who this weekend was used a lot as a fullback and H-back with Darren Waller and Foster Moreau used in those sets. And when they used I formation, you know, they knew Carrier could catch because you've seen him with the 49ers and I think it was a couple other teams where he's been, you know, a usable reserve that you can put on the field and count on him up the seam and underneath. And they were using him as a fullback and kind of like, you know, getting free releases in the middle of the field and getting easy yards as a result of what they could do moving him around like that. So if Carl Tucker can show that kind of versatility as you described, he might be a nice find for a team in the later rounds. And, you know, certainly, you know, getting a chance to talk with you, Russ, about scouting is always going to be a nice find. So I hope that, you know, everyone out there getting the chance to listen, you know, you can follow Russ Landy at Russ Landy on Twitter. And Russ, then is it RussLandy.com with Infectious Scouting?
It is.
Okay.
Yes, it is. Yep.
So you can definitely, and he's got a book coming out this year for, you know, to cover the 2020 NFL draft. Highly recommend it and highly recommend checking out his work. You can find me at Matt Waldman on Twitter, and MattWaldmanRSP.com is the site. And of course, you can check us every other week for this Scout Talk podcast at Matt Waldman RSP Cast. And it's available at all the outlets that you are familiar with and like to use. So on behalf of Russ, I'm Matt. Thanks again. And you guys have a great week.